know about their desire to have children. When Mary indeed became pregnant, Wallace sent mutual friends to see her in order to question her about the state of her confinement. Shortly after Mary, then 41, gave birth to Ernest Jr. on September 27, 1939, Wallace was asked why she and the Duke did not follow suit. "Because," said Wallace witheringly, "the Duke is not air-conditioned." This complex and largely unspoken triangular relationship between the Duke, Wallace, and Hervin came to a symbolic point on June 3, 1937, when the two men stood at either side of her, one the groom, the other giving her away. For all the hoopla surrounding the royal romance of the century, their wedding was a strangely muted affair. The guest list was modest to the point of being perfunctory, populated with French functionaries or acquaintances like Randolph Churchill and Charles and Fern Bidault. Much to the Duke's disappointment, no member of the royal family attended. Contrary to last-minute assurances from his friend Lord Mountbatten, telegrams from the King and Queen and another from Queen Mary didn't really cut it as far as the Duke was concerned. The counterpoint to the threadbare guest list was Wallace's blue silk floor-length wedding dress by her favorite designer, Membauchet. No detail was left to chance, her kid gloves specially designed to accommodate the wedding ring. As soon as the photographs of Membauchet's creation appeared in the popular prints, Wallace's dress was copied by fashion houses around the world. If only Wallace had been allowed to create the wedding of her dreams, that would have been a day to remember. Instead, they had cups of tea on the terrace of the chateau and a brief photo session with the world's media. "Keep your head up for the photographers," he told his bride, his admonition clear to lip readers watching the silent movie reel more than half a century after their union. He also could have told her to keep her spirits up, for failure and disappointment lay at the heart of their union, framing and shaping their future together. It would forever corrode their marriage. As she watched the unfolding drama from afar, Courtney Espiel told her husband that Wallace had a terrific responsibility to make his sacrifice worth it. Her former lover snorted his derision.
"Responsibility? What does she care? She's the sort of woman, if she gets bored to death with him and when the novelty of being your grace wears off, she will leave him one good day, take the millions he gave her, and come to live in America where she can have a good time."
He further predicted,
"She will be fighting with him all the time. She will keep him constantly upset. He is finished so long as he is so completely under her influence. She liked it when he had the glory and glamour of being king. Now alone with him in some quiet place, as an exile? No, she'll never stay unless things get better."
The first test was their honeymoon, where the newlyweds were reminded of the titular space between them. When they arrived at the entrance to Castle Vossar-Leonburg, their hostess, the Countess of Munster, the former Peggy Ward, was there to greet them. She was all smiles, sweeping a deep curtsy to the Duke and walking up to Wallace with her hand out.
"Wallace, congratulations. How well you are looking."
The Duke immediately interjected,
"The Duchess, you mean?"
For the next hour, as Countess Munster recalled, the Duke sulked and pouted, his face screwed up like a naughty little boy. Finally, he apologized and offered his car to take the Countess to the local hotel where she was staying for the night. It was the first of a lifetime of such performances, the endless, small humiliations of their lives to come. Chapter 13. Only one woman exists for him. Inevitably, marriage brought about a step change in the intimacy between Hermann and Wallace. She turned her attentions to her husband, while the Duke, perhaps sensing their closeness, began to keep Hermann at arm's length. The royal couple now had their own secrets and plans from which Herman was firmly excluded. He first sensed the way the wind was blowing when the newlyweds arrived at the 5-star Hotel Le Meurice in Paris, after a lengthy honeymoon, during which they had visited Vienna, Salzburg, and Venice, as well as the hunting lodge in Hungary of the Duke's latest boon companion, Charles Bedeau. Herman watched quietly as the rough-spoken but energetic businessman cast his spell over the former king, mesmerizing him with tales of his early life as a laborer in New York, working for a dollar a day on the Holland Tunnel. It was not just Bedeau's romantic version of his life that captivated the Duke. For the first few weeks of the marriage, he and Wallace had bickered and squabbled about the events leading to the abdication. The Duke was left in no doubt that Wallace considered she would be queen if he hadn't played his hand so badly. During one row at a restaurant in the Austrian Tyrol, she angrily moved to the next table, forcing him to follow her. So when Bedeau suggested an official visit to Germany to tour housing projects, the idea fell on fertile ground. It would give the Duke the chance to show his carping wife that while he may have lost his crown, he still had the prestige of a king. Until now, Wallace had experienced only the downside of royalty, harassed and gawped at every time she ventured out in public. Their stay in Paris epitomized her new life. When she and Constance Coolidge visited Elsa Schiaparelli's showroom at 21 Place Vendôme, hundreds of curious onlookers gathered outside, mobbing her when she left. It was the same when they went to a movie matinee. The only sanctuary was her suite in the Meurice, or Constance's quiet apartment. "She is nervous and afraid to go out," Constance told her father. "It really must be awful." The strain told on her, Constance noting that the Duchess looked very thin and tired. Socially, too, their lives were awkward. The hostility of the House of Windsor ensured that any potential host was stepping on eggshells by inviting them to dinner. When the Duke's former assistant private secretary Lloyd Thomas, now minister at the British Embassy in Paris, hosted a dinner party in their honor, only a handful of French royals accepted the invitation. Others were fearful of social retribution. Inevitably, the English aristocracy were conspicuous by their absence. Into this void stepped the beguiling Mr. Bedeau, using his contacts to organize the contentious visit to Nazi Germany. In late September, Hitler's adjutant, Fritz Wiedemann, flew to Paris from Berlin for a meeting at the Ritz Hotel, where the trio sealed the deal. Somewhat belatedly, Herman, who had joined the Windsors in Paris, realized that Bedeau was a confirmed Nazi sympathizer, speaking of Hitler, his henchmen, and the Third Reich in glowing terms. The Duke and the time and motion maestro were as thick as thieves, and Herman and Catherine, who utterly loathed the Nazi regime, were horrified when they heard them talk. Knowing of the Rogerses' opposition to Hitler, the Duke and Wallace kept them out of the loop, changing the subject abruptly whenever Herman entered the room. On one occasion, not realizing that Herman was in earshot, the Duke, referring to the upcoming visit, said, "Well, has Charles got it fixed?" Wallace shot him a look, and the Duke, as Herman recalled, shut up like a clam. Shortly before October 3, 1937, when the Duke made his announcement of his visit, he asked Herman's opinion. Herman replied, "Sir, my advice is..." Before he could finish the sentence, the Duke interjected sharply, "People don't give me advice, they give me suggestions." Duly put in his place, Herman kept his counsel, aware that the Duke and Wallace were determined to go ahead with a visit that would inevitably create concern in London, controversy around the world, and a glorious propaganda coup for the Nazi regime. So it proved. Squired around a variety of selected housing and labor projects by the bibulous Dr. Robert Ley, head of the labor front, they were feted by the Nazi leadership. Playing with Hermann Göring's famous model train set at Carenhall, his palatial country estate, discussing classical music with Albert Speer, and, the highlight of the trip, taking tea with Hitler at his mountain lair at Berchtesgaden in Bavaria. For once, Wallace, admired for her penetrating scrutiny of her conversational partner, was outgazed by the German leader, his eyes, she recalled, unblinking, magnetic, burning with a peculiar fire. Even as an accomplished flirt, Wallace found no response with Hitler. "I decided he did not care for women," she concluded. In a visit mired in controversy, the Duke's decision to return several Nazi salutes forever sealed his reputation as a Nazi sympathizer. For her part, the Duchess disingenuously said they made the trip as nothing more than tourists. She later explained that it never for an instant crossed David's mind that his mere appearance in Germany might put him in conflict with British foreign policy. Tourists, indeed. Given the knowing secrecy surrounding the planning and the complicity between the Duke, the Duchess, and the Beddoes, she and the Duke were fully aware of the potential for political blowback. Years later, she confessed to Cleveland Amory, "David and I made a foolish mistake, one that both of us were to regret. We allowed ourselves to be persuaded to visit Adolf Hitler's Germany, and the consequence of that decision, casually arrived at, a fresh barrage of criticism crashed around us." The immediate fallout was the last-minute cancellation of a more extensive visit to the United States in November 1937, when the Windsors planned to visit more housing projects across the nation. American labor unions and Jewish organizations mounted angry protests at the prospect of a royal visit so soon after they had toured a country where labor unions were outlawed and Jews persecuted. Once again, the trip was masterminded by Charles Beddoe. They were in a real quandary. Their suite on the German liner Bremen was already booked and paid for, and they had sent 71 pieces of luggage to be loaded on board. The mood of uncertainty in Paris was not helped when Beddoe's public relations guru, Lee Olwell, arrived from New York and told the Windsors face-to-face that their safety could not be guaranteed should they sail for America. Initially, the Duchess was defiant. "America is my country, and nobody is going to hurt me," she insisted. After consultations with the British ambassador in Washington and their friend Bill Bullitt, the American ambassador to France, as well as reviewing the increasingly wild cables from Beddoe, the Duke climbed down and canceled the visit. It was a humiliating debacle, the Duchess so angry that she threw herself on the floor of their hotel suite in a hysterical screaming fit as she realized that her dream of being treated like the homecoming queen had disappeared before her eyes. Olwell later spoke to his friend Thelma Furness about it. "Can you imagine? She had been thrown out of England, and the last thing she wanted was to be thrown out of America." Everyone, friends and foes, had counseled caution, but the Windsors would not listen. Constance Coolidge observed that the proposed tour was a most foolish thing to do, while Herman Rogers described the decision to visit America as untimely. He thought the tour could jeopardize his, the Duke's, eventual usefulness on the world stage. Others were more critical. Courtney Espiel observing trenchantly, "Poor stupid boy with no balance and no judgment. It was his unfortunate choice of friends who threw him in with the group among whom played Mrs. Ernest Simpson. Now he adds to the crumbling walls of his life's stronghold another American friend, Charles Beddoe, who causes him almost as great a scandal as the choice of wife." If the visit to Nazi Germany and the canceled tour of America exposed the Windsors' political naivete, another proposed visit was simply foolhardy. He planned to tour the recently independent Republic of Ireland to discover for himself the real root of evil that had provoked widespread anti-British feeling in that country and beyond,
especially in the United States. Contrary to the settled policy of the British government, the Duke believed in a united Ireland. The rallying cry of the terrorist group, the Irish Republican Army, to the present day. He told the diplomat and writer Sir Shane Leslie, "I have always held very strong views in favor of Ireland becoming united, and in fact always refused official invitations to visit Ulster for this reason." Such a trip, however well-meaning, would have been incendiary, domestically far more inflammatory than his controversial visit to Nazi Germany. Now that he was free of his constitutional shackles as monarch, the Duke felt no compunction about voicing his opinion on world affairs, publicly or privately. At this time he was a vigorous appeaser in favor of peace at any price. During a dinner party at Constance Coolidge's Paris home in March 1938, he characteristically dismissed all thought of going to war to save Czechoslovakia, a country which gained independence only after World War I, and was now next on Hitler's shopping list of conquests. "Czechoslovakia is a ridiculous country. How could anyone go to war for that?" he argued. "It's not a country at all, just an idea of President Wilson." Years later, the Duke reflected on his folly, bemoaning the lack of advice he had received at this critical juncture of his new detached royal life. Remembering his own experience in Paris, Herman asked him if he or the Duchess would have listened if advice had been at hand. Ruefully, the Duke admitted that it would have changed nothing. With his uniquely intimate insight, Herman concluded that they were two strong people who needed even stronger people to counsel them. Wallis needed a stronger man than her husband to guide her, and the Duke needed a wiser partner. When she dabbled in politics, as in the proposed visit to her home country, she was a disaster who became, in Herman's view, like a wild animal when angry. While the ex-king had escaped the cage of Buckingham Palace, it left him prey to an exotic and sinister array of oddballs, misfits, and conspiracy theorists. As Prince of Wales, he had been targeted by several stalkers, usually women, whose behavior brought them to the attention of Scotland Yard. One such obsessive, a kindergarten teacher, became involved at the fringes of a spy plot and was jailed for a time. In the feverish climate before the outbreak of World War II, the Windsors and their allies were natural targets. Perhaps the most extraordinary intrigue involved Wallace's friend, Constance Coolidge, several months after the Windsors' visit to Germany. Unwittingly, she found herself at the heart of a plot to blackmail the Duke and the royal family. In March 1938, Constance was contacted by a certain Madame Maroney, who wanted to see Wallis and the Duke urgently about some incriminating photographs, papers, and letters. Reluctantly, after much pestering, Constance agreed to take tea in Maroney's Paris apartment. The building was seedy, the third-floor apartment as queer as the woman who lived there. As she talked, Madame Maroney, who Constance concluded was an adventuress, revealed that she had followed the Duke around Austria before and during his honeymoon, as well as to the seaside town of Le Touquet in northern France. Bizarrely, she promised to burn the incriminating papers if she met with the Duke in order to see for herself if he was happily married. At this point, Constance's butler, Victor, worried that his mistress had come to harm, burst into the room, effectively ending the interview. Eventually, Constance told Wallace and the police about this curious encounter. Both the French police and Scotland Yard were called in. They discovered that Madame Maroney had worked for a time as a maid for the Duke and had sensitive letters relating to the Duke's German cousin, the Nazi diplomat, Prince Philip von Hessen. At this delicate time, with the peace of Europe hanging in the balance, Hessen was used as a go-between, a man linked by blood to the House of Windsor, who also had the ear of Hitler. His correspondence, if made public, would have been highly discomforting, especially to the new king and his brothers who were secretly negotiating with their German cousin. Constance was interviewed by the police on several occasions, once in front of the Duke himself. She was even forced to repeat Moroni's allegation about a man who renounced a throne and had a mistress in Austria, clearly a reference to the Duke and his hostess at Schloss Enzisfeld, Kitty Rothschild. It was very embarrassing, Constance noted in her diary. The unsubstantiated allegations of an affair aside, the possible existence of correspondence between the House of Windsor and Prince Philip von Hessen was potentially embarrassing for all concerned, as the royal family would have been seen to be meddling in matters of sensitive diplomacy, which went way beyond their constitutional remit. At the time, the incident was promptly hushed up, the ducal couple never speaking of the matter again, even with Constance. In any case, they had other matters on their minds, furnishing their first house. While the royal couple announced through Constance's newspaper contacts that they would one day settle in England, their immediate plans were focused on France, having finally decided to rent the palatial Château de la Croix, the Riviera mansion where Wallace had originally wanted to marry. Her talk was now of servants, furnishings and fabrics, place settings, rather than politics, spies and stolen letters. Elsie Mendel and Johnny McMullen, together with designers Stéphane Boudin and Tony Montgomery, helped to integrate the Duke's furniture and personal effects in the Windsor's Cap d'Antibes home. Their goal, according to Mendel's biographer Charlie Shipes, was to create a semi-royal ambiance befitting the exiles' continued illusions of grandeur despite their fall from grace. They used so many mirrors to emphasize the sense of space that the Duchess was nicknamed Wallace Through the Looking Glass. The Duke's priceless collection of royal silverware and other family heirlooms was transported from storage in Windsor Castle. During the entire process of unpacking and redecorating, the Duke took great delight in designing his insignias and crests, which decorated everything from the stationery to the liveried footman's red and gold frock coats. The Duchess, too, was in her element, her relentless eye for detail and near-photographic memory ensuring that her new home ran with clockwork precision. Less kindly visitors, seeing at first hand the Duchess' total domination over her husband, described their home as organized like a well-run nursery. It was, though, this home that would seal her status as one of the most celebrated hostesses of her era. There was a nagging undertow of disappointment, not with her new home, but her new neighbors. She and the Duke had yet to win over the Riviera set. It piqued her protective nature to see the English so rude to their former sovereign, likening a visit to the casino at Monte Carlo to being an exhibit in a zoo. The crowd were just awful, standing around and looking at them. It angered her even more that the Duke didn't even seem to notice what people were saying or doing. "Do you realize he has never told his side of the story?" Wallace asked Constance. "He has never said one word. Do people give him credit for that?" One consolation was that her Herman was only a short car journey away, the Rogerses their regular companions, be it for dinner, lunch, or holidays. That summer, the Rogerses and the Windsors hired the yacht Gulzar for a leisurely cruise along the Italian coast, visiting Portofino, the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and Sorrento. In celebration of their new home, the newlyweds decided to hold their first Christmas party, inviting friends from London and Paris to the grand affair. Johnny McMullen decorated the huge Christmas tree in the entrance hall, and Wallace, rising to the challenge, looked stunning in a heavily embroidered evening dress and a sparkling diamond necklace, which the Duke gave her as a Christmas present. A gypsy orchestra played until the early hours, and Lady Brownlow tried to teach the guests, who included the Rogerses and the Mendels, the Lambeth Walk. The Duke didn't even seem to mind that no one curtsied to his wife when she entered the room. If he did, he affected not to notice. All evening, he only had eyes for Wallace. Her friend Constance Coolidge, Comtesse de Jumelac, who was seated next to the Duke, later remarked, "He is difficult to talk to, for having a single-track mind, only one woman exists for him. All the others are just bores. This is really true, yet he likes to talk to me."
She stayed as a guest of the Rogerses, finding the newly remodeled Louvier not to her taste. Even the ghost agreed, Constance noting that it had not been seen since the renovation had been completed. As for Catherine and Herman, not only were they no longer sleeping together, their drinking habits were making them tiresome. "Neither Herman nor Kay, Catherine, can drink as well as before. They don't get a bit tight. Catherine becomes more intense and positive, and H can't enunciate words properly. Herman has lost his pep." And he was lost in his own world. On Christmas Day, he came into the living room, took his presents, and returned to his bedroom, where he opened them on his own. If she noticed, Wallace never mentioned it, nor did it impair her intimacy with him. When she and the Duke were considering renting a home in Paris, it was Herman she asked to give 24 Boulevard Suchet the once-over. After he approved her choice, she called in Elsie Mendel to help with the interior design. She used her unique contact book to help Wallace in her search for antiques and other objets for their townhouse. On the way, she introduced Wallace to the rich Americans and well-heeled Parisiennes who would populate her dining table. Much to Herman's astonishment, she even started taking French lessons and read 4 French newspapers a day to get a sense of the country she was living in. The Windsors now entertained at home twice a week, usually 1 or 2 tables of 10. By then, the routine was more settled. The butler announced the arrival of Her Royal Highness, the Duchess of Windsor, after guests gathered for cocktails. "It was," observed the Countess Munster, "quite a performance." When Wallace arrived fashionably late, she expected the various groups of guests to break up to await her greeting. "I wouldn't have expected such a behavior from the Queen herself," recalled Countess Munster. "It was as if in 2 years she had learned that people weren't going to accept her and learned to face them down herself." The one place where the Duke and Duchess were assured a deferential welcome was the German embassy. It was here on June 22, 1939, just weeks before war was declared, where they were guests of honor. Wallace sparkling in a white gown decorated with rubies and diamonds which the Duke had given her for her 43rd birthday. The following night, the Duke's 45th birthday, saw the couple at a charity ball to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the opening of the Eiffel Tower. The declaration of war on September 3, 1939, which was provoked by Hitler's invasion of Poland, changed everything and nothing. The Windsors briefly returned from exile, the Duke visiting his brother, the King, at Buckingham Palace to discuss a suitable job. At this time of national peril, there was no thaw in royal relations. Though the Duke did see his mother, Queen Mary, the royal family gave Wallace the complete cold shoulder. With such a frigid atmosphere at home, the Duke, who was seconded as a liaison officer between the British and French forces in Vincennes, northern France, was glad to return to their adopted country. He spent weeks visiting French troop positions and writing several reports about the lack of preparedness of French anti-tank batteries. Like the Duke himself, his findings were studiously ignored. As a result, he spent more time on his golf than his gunnery, staying at their home in Paris for much of the so-called phony war. When Wallace's friend Claire Booth Luce suggested he lobby for more time at the front, the Duchess cried, "What, and get himself killed in this silly war?" It was a sentiment that pithily summarized their thinking. Sidelined and treated with suspicion by the top brass, the Duke found himself acting as a cheerleader for his bride,
who for once found herself the busier of the two. As honorary president of the Colis de Trianon Versailles, a charity set up by Elsie Mendel to send care packages to French frontline troops, she found herself hard at work organizing volunteers. She also delivered plasma, bandages, and other supplies to frontline units, the Duke eager for the world to recognize her pluck. She was, he said proudly, often billeted near the sound of gunfire. Even though, as an American, she was neutral, Wallace admitted that she was busier and perhaps more useful than I had ever been in my life. All that changed on May 10, 1940, when German divisions advanced through Belgium, threatening French and British lines and creating panic in Paris. Elsie Mendel abandoned her war work and, together with her husband Charles and John McMullen, headed south, Gertrude Stein and her lover Alice B. Toklas not far behind. The Duke gravely gave Wallace 2 hours to pack before they shut up their rented house and joined the general retreat. She was not so easily convinced, nor, after the farrago of the abdication, did she have much faith in his judgment. Before she agreed to his demand, she decided to seek the advice of her friend, American Ambassador Bill Bullitt, before making up her own mind. Bullitt, multilingual, whip-smart and shrewd, was the Paris version of Herman, a sensible backstop by which to measure her husband's often half-baked decisions. Suggestions, advanced by her biographer Charles Higgum, that Bullitt and Wallace were lovers, are wide of the mark. While their private correspondence was friendly, it consisted mainly of thank-you notes. Though superficially affable, Bullitt had little respect for the couple. He left me realizing more fully what a pathetic, ineffectual, but charming little fellow Edward really is, recalled Courtney Espiel after a confidential conversation with the diplomat. Yet Bullitt, a regular diner at the Boulevard Suchet table, had to acknowledge that their uneven relationship worked. I have never seen any man in all of my life who is so blindly in love with a woman as the poor little Duke. When she enters the room, he seems to immediately forget all else. On that day, his advice to Wallace was to forget anything other than leaving that very afternoon. She and the Duke did as he bid, the couple driving off without a word to the Duke's local equerry and boon companion, Fruity Metcalf, who had hosted them at his country home during their brief stay in England. The Irishman, who had to make his own way back to England without transport, told his wife furiously, "He deserted his job in 1936. Well, he's deserted his country now, at a time when every office boy and cripple is trying to do what he can. It is the end." It was an early example of a pattern, the Duke and Duchess discarding those who had served them loyally without a backward glance. It has since been argued that the Duke left his military post without permission. Others have suggested that the army hierarchy breathed a collective sigh of relief when he headed south. After stopping the night at Blois, they headed for Biarritz, watering hole of the rich and famous. While they were eating luncheon of fruit and cheese under the shade of a tree, they were overtaken by the Mendel convoy. Wallace told Elsie that she had slept in a sleeping bag the night before because their room was so dirty. As the Duke slept, she heard him whispering, "England," and muttering that he must go to England. Once they arrived in Biarritz, the scene that greeted them was simply extraordinary. As John McMullen wrote, "I have never seen so many Rolls-Royces, maids, valets, and dogs gathered together under so few roofs. It is the last stand of elegance. All the rich people of Europe are here." When German radio correctly stated the hotel room number where Wallace was staying, the Duke having returned to his military mission in Vincennes, she was treated like a bad smell by fellow guests who believed that the hotel would now be the Nazis' number one bombing target. The Duke returned a few days later with orders to join the forces assembled on the Italian border, where Mussolini's troops were massing. He gave Herman Rogers another, less savory reason why they left.
In a letter to his sister Anne, dated June 4, 1940, Herman wrote, "First they battled their way through refugees to Biarritz, which they found so revoltingly overflowing with all the Jews of Europe that they couldn't stand it, and came on to Croay." During that journey, the Duke heard on his portable radio that his friend King Leopold of the Belgians had surrendered to the Germans. Wallace saw his face set in the same grim mold as during the abdication crisis. The bleak news triggered something deep inside the Duke, as Wallace observed. All his pent-up emotion came out over the empty role forced on him. It was all too much. "God, I wish there was something I could do," said the Duke. "I feel so useless. As an Englishman, I hate running." Once back in their Riviera retreat, Wallace suggested that she stay with the Rogerses while he returned to England. He dismissed the idea out of hand. Until the situation became clearer, they decided to follow the advice of U.S. Ambassador Anthony Biddle, who had just made a perilous escape from Warsaw, Poland's capital. He told them that a slit trench and a steel helmet were the best defense against air raids. The Duke had a trench dug out in the La Croix garden, complete with food hamper, magazines, thermos flask, and a padded garden chair for the Duchess. When Herman came to inspect the royal fortifications, he pronounced them acceptable, but preferred the thick walls of Louviers. Under the circumstances, he found the couple cool and collected, even though that very morning an air raid siren had sounded, and the subsequent raid by Italian bombers had killed a 3-year-old girl. The sojourn in the Riviera sunshine was brief. With the news that Nazi panzer tank brigades were headed to Bordeaux, royal packing went forward in the utmost frenzy. As they couldn't take the Duke's priceless family silverware, he decided to leave his precious collection in trustworthy French hands, a friend recommending a village in the mountains behind Cannes where it could be stored for the duration of the conflict. The Duke rented a truck and dispatched the valuable cargo. Later, Wallace told her friend Eleanor Miles that it cost the scarcely believable sum of $12,000, $200,000 at today's prices, to hide the silver, and a further $12,000 to recover it after the war. As for Wallace's extensive jewelry collection, they held that close, packed away in their personal luggage. They still joshed one another about the time on their honeymoon when Wallace's gems were left on the running board of their car during a trip to Salzburg. Fortunately, the jewels were recovered safe and sound. As they pondered their uncertain future, they weren't about to make the same mistake again. Chapter 14. A Whole Nation Against One Woman. Royal pride, coming before the fall of France, threatened to place the Windsors in danger. Even as they packed their precious belongings, the Duke hesitated about leaving his newly adopted country. The dramatic arrival in mid-June 1940 of the disheveled, ravenous figure of their comptroller, Grey Phillips, changed all that. He had hitchhiked his way from Paris, loyally bringing with him several of the Duke's treasured George II silver bibelots. His exhausted presence now embodied their increasingly perilous situation. Yet when the local part-time British consul offered them a berth on one of the two cargo ships that were due to sail from Cannes the following day, the Duke considered it an insult that they were restricted to only two suitcases. He thought a destroyer should be sent to collect them. Stubborn and willful, the Duke decided to sit it out, much against the advice of Phillips, who had seen for himself the utter capitulation of France. Their neighbors, Captain George and Rosa Wood, added to the chorus urging retreat. Their daughter, Marie-Thérèse, who was married to Prince Ernst of Hohenberg, had been arrested when the Nazis invaded Vienna and had not been seen since. The couple were incarcerated in Dachau concentration camp, but both survived the war. With the Duke's habitual obstinacy stopping him from seeing sense, in desperation, Wallace contacted the one man she could always rely upon, Herman Rogers. He agreed with the others, reminding them of an uncomfortable home truth, namely the widespread suspicion concerning the couple's pro-German behavior. Remember, if you stay and the Germans take you, many people will say that you gave yourself up deliberately, he told them. The Germans will see to it that such an impression gets abroad. As a clinching point, he added, You have seen enough of the Nazis to know that they are extremely nasty people. I wouldn't anticipate a comfortable internment in their hands. His argument tipped the balance. The Windsors decided to leave for Spain on Wallace's birthday, June 19th, their precious linens, porcelains, and family heirlooms left behind. Curiously, in a letter to his sister Anne, Herman gave an entirely different version. He told her that he thought the Windsors should have remained in France rather than join the general retreat. I think the Duke should have stayed. Better still, the Duke should never have left his military mission, though he was ordered out of Paris by the British ambassador. Nearly everyone lost his head during the last days, and it is hard to blame them. The panic amongst the English colony was indescribable, pitiful, but somehow revolting. He and Catherine remained in Cannes until September 1941, Herman becoming a Red Cross organizer, delivering wheat and other basic supplies to remote mountain villages. From time to time, he sent letters to Undersecretary of State Sumner Wells, a fellow Groton alumnus, describing bombing raids and the sense of fear and panic that now gripped the civilian population. Wells forwarded his missives to President Roosevelt to give him a first-hand flavor of the war in France. The president was so impressed by his communiques that once Herman had returned to New York, he received an invitation for lunch at the White House to give the president a trusted first-hand account of life in Vichy, France. As for the Windsors, their vacillation about staying or going continued long after they finally reached Madrid in fascist but still nominally neutral Spain. Their prevarication was to have sinister consequences. The initial plan was for the Windsors to drive west from the Spanish capital to Lisbon in Portugal and fly back to London on two Sunderland seaplanes, which had been dispatched on Prime Minister Churchill's orders. The Duke, pig-headed to the last, chose this moment of national peril to negotiate an improved position for himself and his wife. He refused to return to Britain unless he was given a significant post, and Wallace was granted equal status to himself and received by his family at Buckingham Palace, this meeting to be acknowledged in the court circular. Without this agreement, he proposed to remain on mainland Europe. During this back and forth between Madrid and London, the Windsors considered returning to La Croix, feeling that the immediate threat from the Nazis and Mussolini had passed. Wallace telegrammed Herman on July 9th, hinting at this possibility and asking if all was still safe in the south of France. Perhaps they are going to try to come back, he mused. In behavior that could be described as foolhardy or treacherous or both, on two separate occasions, while in Madrid and later in Lisbon, the Duke used a Spanish intermediary to secretly contact the Germans to ask them to guard their homes. The German high command willingly agreed to these requests. Unbeknown to the Windsors, the Nazis had already hatched a plot, codenamed Operation Willy, to kidnap the royal couple and use them as pawns in the coming invasion of Britain. They employed similar tactics when they overran other European monarchies, notably Norway and the Netherlands. They wanted to use the royal heads of state as puppets, to order the military and civilian population to accept Nazi rule. Fortunately, these royal families had escaped Nazi clutches. As the plot to kidnap the Windsors unfolded, Hitler and von Ribbentrop were encouraged by reports sent by their ambassadors in Madrid and Lisbon of the Windsors' contempt for George VI and their defeatist talk, suggesting that heavy German bombing would soon bring Britain to its knees. While the Duke and Duchess were unaware of the Nazi plot, their behavior dovetailed neatly with German ambitions. Their utter self-absorption caused them to teeter on the brink of a Nazi trap. As the Duke's younger brother, Prince George, noted sadly,
"They are extraordinary people, and never bother about anyone except themselves."
It was only when Churchill used the carrot-and-stick approach that the crisis was resolved. First, he reminded the Duke that he was a serving army officer and should obey orders. Failure to do so could result in a court-martial. Then he offered him the governorship of the Bahamas, which he reluctantly accepted. It was, as Wallace sourly observed, their Elba, a reference to Napoleon's exile on a small Mediterranean island. Significant questions about the behavior of the royal couple remain. As they had already squirreled away their silverware and other valuables in the mountains, why would the Duke, a serving major general, even feel the need to contact the Nazis to safeguard their rented homes? The American consul had already agreed to seal their Cannes property, thus technically safeguarding it from all access. Furthermore, at the Duchess's request, the consul had visited La Croix and sent her favorite swimsuit to Lisbon, where she and the Duke were then staying. As a further failsafe, Herman Rogers was acting as the Duke's unpaid agent, overseeing payments to staff as well as undertaking other administrative work. The Duke sent him £1,000 initially to pay hungry and faithful servants as well as outstanding bills. Further amounts were sent during the first years of the war. More by luck than design, the plot to kidnap the ducal couple came to naught. On August 1st, watched by the bitterly disappointed German spymaster Major Walter Schellenberg, the couple sailed for Bermuda on board the Excalibur in the company of several senior American diplomats, including William Phillips, ambassador to Italy, George Gordon, the minister to The Hague, and Anthony Biddle, ambassador to Poland. During the voyage, the Windsors regularly entertained them to tea, regaling them with their indiscreet views on Hitler, Churchill, and the progress of the war. The Duke painted himself as a pro-German appeaser who thought the fighting stupid and openly claimed that their tenure in the Bahamas was not going to be long. They thought they were going to return to England in a high capacity once the warring parties had come to terms. Given his diplomatic audience, his pessimistic view soon reached the ears of officials in the State Department and the White House. As for Wallace, she was even more stupidly outspoken against the British government than he, recalled Alice Gordon, the wife of Minister George Gordon. She had been a friend of Wallace's during her days in Washington when Wallace was the down-at-heel estranged wife of Navy flyer Win Spencer. Alice had given her clothes and let her stay in her apartment when she had nowhere else to go. During that fateful Atlantic crossing, Wallace brazenly chose to ignore Alice, not even acknowledging her when they passed in the corridor. It was as if she did not want to recognize her past or allow her husband a glimpse into the world she once occupied. This new Wallace now ruled a domain of some 29 islands and 70,000 people, mainly poor blacks and people of mixed race. It was a Ruritanian world seemingly designed to keep her in a state of exasperation, irritation, and humiliation. To her mind, it was as if she had been shipwrecked on an inhospitable desert island, forced to endure the stifling heat and humidity which she abhorred, and subject to the endless stings and bites of the cloud of two-bit socialites who surrounded her. From the moment she set foot in Nassau to the day she left, she occupied a secondary status to her husband. The standing Foreign Office instruction was that islanders should bow and curtsy to the governor, but not to the governor's wife. She was Her Grace. He was His Royal Highness. Every day, in every way, she was reminded that Buckingham Palace rules held sway. It gnawed away at her soul, blaming that woman, the new queen, as the unseen hand behind her continued persecution. At the official welcome, she sat on a chair lower than the Duke's but above the rest of the official audience. The Duke, as he did for the rest of his life, insisted that their staff at Government House refer to Wallace as Your Royal Highness. It was too much for an English maid called Firth, who walked out in protest.
"I couldn't do it. I would have choked," she explained.
The homemaker in Wallace was horrified by the state of their ersatz palace, Government House, the official home of every governor since 1801. After carefully and lovingly redecorating La Croix and Boulevard Suchet, she could hardly bear to stay a night in the crumbling, careworn official residence. She had spent half a lifetime in dingy, threadbare lodgings with either her mother or her first husband. Now the woman who came within an ace of being crowned queen was reduced once again to the shabby and the utilitarian. Government House was not, in her opinion, fit for an ex-king, and it was certainly not fit for Wallace, who wanted to bury her past, not embrace it. When she first toured the 7-bedroom, 6-bathroom wooden house, complete with termites, she sniffed, "But how primitive!" The last straw was when a chunk of ceiling came crashing down in their sitting room. Wallace demanded that the Duke do something, insisting that the residence be remodeled. The new governor managed to snag a grant from the island's executive council to restore the building to his wife's liking. In the meantime, the itinerant royals lodged elsewhere, for a time staying in Westbourne, the mansion of the island's wealthiest man, Sir Harry Oakes, where, 3 years later, he would be murdered. They stayed there reluctantly, the colonial office having turned down the Duke's request to sojourn at his ranch in Alberta, Canada for the duration of the renovations. This set the pattern which lasted throughout their 5-year tenure, the Duke and Duchess the royal version of Robinson Crusoe and his girl Friday. They looked for any excuse, any life raft, to allow them to escape from the islands they both hated. Madison Avenue, not Bay Street, Nassau, was Wallace's natural hunting ground. Long-established families quickly sensed her resentment at being posted to this benighted territory, feeling that she always had one hand on the door, one foot on the floor, eager to leave. "We were provincials to her. She didn't warm to us, and we didn't warm to her," recalled one Nassau socialite. No one was on first-name terms with her. As far as she was able, Wallace lived, if not physically, then vicariously, through her home country.
"Be sure to say hello to New York for me," she would tell departing American visitors.
She sent her dry cleaning to New York, and quietly flew in her Manhattan hairdresser, Forrest of Antoine, putting him up in a local hotel. She liked his recipe for keeping her hair shiny and nourished, an egg shampoo with 2 jiggers of rum. During the renovations and beyond, she used Elsie Mendel and John McMullen, now living on the Upper East Side, to discreetly shop for her. Otherwise, she relied on the services of Mary Bork, her former secretary, who had left her to work for Kitty Rothschild. What with currency restrictions, import duty, and, of course, Wallace's image as a spendthrift, she had to be careful in her purchases, which ranged from candlesticks, cocktail glasses, furs, and gloves, to silver picture frames and fancy Christmas gifts chosen by Mr. Cartier himself. More prosaic items included Francis Fox hair ointment and Ogilvy Sisters dandruff tonic. She was highly sensitive to accusations that she was splashing out on fripperies when Britain was suffering bombing and rationing. In spite of her best efforts, one newspaper report suggested she had bought 34 hats during a brief shopping trip. Wallace was quick to contradict it, saying that the number was 5, which she felt was not outrageous. Many others did. This hostility perhaps explains why she sent a tart note to Mary Bork, reminding her that her silence was vital in this undercover shopping enterprise, emphasizing that certain arrangements were of the most confidential and private nature. Of course, Wallace would have preferred to visit luxury stores herself so that she could replace what she called her refugee rags with a more modish wardrobe.
It was, though, their own folly that kept them imprisoned on the islands longer than was strictly necessary. Prime Minister Churchill feared, with good reason, that their defeatist talk would only give succor to isolationists who saw the Duke as their poster boy in keeping America out of the war. It was why the ducal couple were prevented from sailing to the Bahamas via New York, lest the loose-lipped Duke commit some diplomatic faux pas. Their unpatriotic chatter with American diplomats on board the Excalibur simply continued once they arrived in Nassau, nor did their choice of friends assuage suspicion regarding their loyalties. The Duke's close association with Swedish businessman and suspected Nazi collaborator, Axel Wenner Gren, was an immediate red flag. The Swede, a confidant of Hermann Göring, was in the crosshairs of the governments of both Britain and the United States, intelligence experts believing he was an enemy agent. It was yet another example of the Duke's lack of judgment and discretion. Such was his attachment to Wenner Gren, described by Roosevelt's advisor Harry Hopkins as violently pro-Nazi, that Churchill took it upon himself to send a top-secret cable in March 1941, warning him to steer clear of the dubious Swede. His caution coincided with the publication of an interview the Duke gave to Liberty magazine, which the Prime Minister deemed defeatist and pro-Nazi. The Windsors paid the price. Churchill decided that it would not be prudent to allow them to visit America until their views more closely chimed with those of the British government. If anything, Wallace was more trenchant than the Duke in her criticism of the British, asserting that the suffering of the man and woman in the street was karmic payback for the way the royal family had treated her. At dinner one evening, Wallace told Captain Wood, who was now working for them as an unpaid aide, that she wished Germany had licked England. Observing that, but for Roosevelt's decision to lend and lease warships to Britain, the country would surely have been defeated. On another occasion, during a discussion about a new American loan to Britain, she blurted out, "Wouldn't you think that now they are asking for this money, the least they could do would be to recognize me?" Much as she tried to make light of it, the absence of an HRH appellation was a permanent scar. Her self-absorption even shocked her friends. During the early days of the war, she was with Claire Booth Luce, who expressed her sympathy for innocent civilians living on the south coast of England who had been strafed by Luftwaffe fighters. "After what they did for me, I can't say I feel sorry for them. A whole nation against one woman." It became a staple of her wartime conversation. Apart from a brief visit to Miami, where Wallace had a painful molar tooth extracted, the couple remained on their steamy, open prison for more than a year before Churchill relented. In September 1941, he gave them license to travel to the 4,000-acre ducal ranch in Alberta, Canada, and to visit her family in Baltimore, with stopovers in New York and Washington. While President Roosevelt signaled his approval, inviting them for lunch at the White House, he privately remained leery, instructing FBI Chief J. Edgar Hoover to have his agents monitor the Windsors during their stay. Indeed, such was the suspicion surrounding Wallace that her mail was formally censored long after America joined the war. If anything, mistrust of the couple only intensified after the arrest in November 1942 of their friend Charles Badeau on charges of collaboration. He committed suicide in 1944 while in a Miami prison awaiting trial. When asked for comment, the Duke nervously remained silent. Though the Washington establishment were chary, Wallace was thrilled at the opportunity at last to show her husband her hometown. Baltimore did not let them down. More than 200,000 flag-waving people lining the streets as the royal homecoming queen waved and posed, Mayor Howard W. Jackson insisting that they call Baltimore their second home. This was more like it. They stayed at the farm home of her uncle, General Henry Warfield, the Duchess making sure that the local delicacies of crab cakes and fried chicken were on the menu. During her stay,
Her one-time friend, Mary Kirk, now married to Ernest Simpson, died in London of cancer. She was just 45 and had only recently given birth to a baby son, Ernest Jr. Mary had found genuine and